compound statement is called a conditional statement, conditional. Sometimes you hear the term hypothetical or implication also. An implication or a hypothetical statement or a conditional statement. If such and such, then such and such. Those functional words, if and then, indicate the kind of a relationship. Those aren't the only words in English that can indicate this, but it's convenient to start with to give you the idea. The first part of such a statement is called the antecedent, and the second part is called the consequent. So the antecedent and the consequent. The first part, if such and such, then such and such. The first part is called the antecedent, the second part is called the consequent. Other terms that are sometimes used for antecedents, you sometimes see the term prothesis, P-R-O-T-A-S-I-S, prothesis. And for consequent, you'll see apodosis, A-P-O-D-A-S-I-S. So those are terms you'll sometimes see. But for our purposes, we'll just use the terms antecedent and consequent. They're real clear. No question about getting mixed up and so forth. So, for example, we could have a statement, if P, then Q. It's a general statement. This would be the antecedent. This would be the consequent, Q. Okay. Now, a conditional statement then asserts that its antecedent implies its consequent. If the antecedent's true, then the consequent is true. The antecedent implies its consequent. Now, notice that a conditional statement does not assert that its antecedent is true. Only that if the antecedent is true, then the consequent is true. It's not stating that the antecedent is true. It's just saying if P, then Q. It's not saying P is true. It's just saying that if P is true, then Q is true. That's a conditional statement. So it's just making a statement that if P is true, then Q is true. It does not assert that its antecedent is true necessarily. Doesn't assert it at all. It only says that if it's true, then the consequent is true. Now, there are different types of implications in language, and there are different reasons why if one statement is true, another statement might be true. There's cause and effect relationships and other things that get involved here. But for the purposes of a logician, the only thing that really matters is the simple statement, if P, then Q. Regardless of any kinds of causal connections or any kind of intrinsic connection between the statements, that, for the purposes of logic, is irrelevant. We don't need to know why if P, then Q. All we need to know is if P, then Q. And so there's no real connection implied by the statement if P, then Q. They may be completely unrelated as far as cause and effect. But if it's true that if P, then Q, you see, that's what the logician is interested in. So I'm just going to try to avoid a lot of philosophical argument here and talk about this particular issue. You can do some more reading on that if you'd like on occasion. But as it all ends up in the end result, it's simply a matter of if P, then Q, irrespective of what connections there might be between them. So all that is asserted here is the fact that if it is not the case, and this is another way of thinking of it, if P, then Q is simply stating that it is not the case that the antecedent is true and the consequent is false. All it's really telling you. It's not the case that the antecedent is true and this is false, because if the antecedent, this states that if the antecedent is true, then this is true also. Therefore, it's not the case that if this is true, then this is false. That's what it's really trying to tell you. Now, this relation is defined by the following truth table and the symbol of horseshoe. That's what it's called, the horseshoe. It looks like that horseshoe laid over its side. And that's the symbol that is indicating the material implication, as it's called. Material implication or implicative function is some of those terms. Implicative function or the material implication makes a conditional statement. Okay, so it's defined by the following truth table, P, Q, and then P horseshoe Q. Okay, and I'm taking our different combination. Now, if P then Q is true, so in the first case, if P is true and Q is true, then P horseshoe Q is going to be what? Yeah, it'll be true. Because if P then Q, since both of them are true, that's exactly what we would expect from this. If P then Q in this case, though, P is true and Q is false, is P horseshoe Q going to be true? how it would be false. Because in this case, we have P true, but Q is false, then the statement if P then Q becomes false. Because if P not Q, and we're you know, Q is not true, so the statement is false. Okay, now these are the tricky ones. If P is false and Q is true, then is the conditional true or false? It's true. It's true. Because all the conditionals stating is that if P is true, then Q is also true. If P does not happen to be true, the conditional still, the requirements of the conditional are still satisfied. The conditional does not become a false statement because P isn't true. And if P isn't true, it's not telling you anything about what Q could be. Q can be anything if P isn't true. And the whole statement, P horseshoe Q, is still a true statement if P is not true. And then the same is true here. If this is false and this is false, this still becomes true because this being false has no implication or no pressure with regard to Q, and the whole statement is still true. Yeah.
If Q is false, I imagine.
Right.
You're not trying to exactly square it from Q because if P and Q, if both are false, then it's not necessarily true.
This is the whole problem hinges on the fact that the logician is defining this function this way. It may not necessarily correspond to some statement that you might find, but this is the logical definition of this particular horseshoe function. Of course, we've got a right to define it any way we want, but as it turns out, a conditional statement is just that. You have to bear in mind the fact that it's a conditional statement. A conditional statement is true only if the antecedent is true and the consequent is true. It's true under those conditions, and it's still true, the conditional is still true, even if the antecedent is false, because if the antecedent is false, then if P then Q is going to be true, because P isn't true, and it's putting no pressure on what Q has to be, it can be anything it wants. So it's a little bit hard to get used to that, and I think the best way to define this is through the truth table here, and just knowing how these symbols line up. That's the best way. After you work with it for a while, then you begin to get an intuitive understanding of it. And in practice, the only times that we really even worry about this is when the antecedent is true. And see, that's the only time that it makes any sense anyway. See, it doesn't make any sense even make a statement if the antecedent can be false. And when you're dealing with an argument, of course, then that becomes all the more important. But bear this in mind, and this is going to be our actual definition of P horseshoe Q. This is the truth table function. But it's good to note that the conditional is still true even if the antecedent is false. And it's true whether the consequent is true or false. The conditional statement is still true. Okay, now, all of this conditional statement is really telling us is that it is not the case that P is true and Q is false. That's all it's saying. That you'll never have a case where this is true and this is false. And we see in our truth table that the only place where that occurs makes this statement false. And all of the other ones are true. It's true every place except where you have the antecedent true and the consequent false. That makes the whole conditional statement false. Then if P, then Q is not true, because now you have P true but Q false, and that makes the whole statement false. So this means that this horseshoe symbol can be defined in other symbols that we've already used. If the horseshoe is stating that it is not the case that P is true and Q is false, then we can. This means that if P horseshoe Q is true, then P and not Q must be false. Okay. Now the reason for that is this P horseshoe Q symbol is telling us that if P is true, then Q has to be true also. And then, if that's the case, if P is true and Q is true, then if Q is true, not Q is false. And what this is stating is you can't have both P true and Q false. And so this becomes equivalent to, P horseshoe Q becomes equivalent to the negation of this. In other words, and I'll show you from a truth table, sometimes a little bit hard to see when you look at it this way, but when you put it in the truth table, you see it comes out exactly the same. In other words, P horseshoe Q is the same as saying not P and not Q. In other words, it's not the case that P is true and Q false or not Q is true. Okay? You see, remember our conjunctive function. The only way the conjunctive function can be true is if both of these members are true. And what this is saying is that both of these statements cannot be true. You can't have P true and not Q also true, because that would mean that Q is false. And so this is saying this will not be the case. It will not be the case that P is true and Q is false. And that's all that this statement says. Not P and not Q. Now, if you don't believe that, let's look at it in the truth table and see if that's the case or not. Here's our truth table for P horseshoe Q. Not Q is going to be what? If Q is true, not Q is going to be false. If Q is false, not Q will be true. If Q is true, not Q is false, vice versa. So not Q is just the opposite. Now, let's put in our table then, the next step is P and not Q. Okay? So we have to combine these two tables together in terms of the conjunction. Okay, in the first case, if not Q is false and P is true, then P and not Q is going to be true. What true or false? False, okay? If not Q is true and P is true, then this is going to be P and not Q is going to be what? True. Now, remember our conjunction, it's only true if both members are true, okay? They're both false here, so it's going to be false, and one's true and one's false here, so it's going to be false. So that's the truth table we have for this. Now, not P and not Q is found simply by negating this column. We've got P and not Q here, and negation of that is going to be what? Well, if P and not Q is false, then the negation of it is going to be true, right? And if this is true, this is going to be false. If this is false, it's going to be true. If this is false, it's going to be true. And lo and behold, if you compare this column with this column, P horseshoe Q, you have true, false, true, true. It's the exact same truth table. So, this is where in some logic books they'll define the horseshoe this way. They'll just say the horseshoe is not P and not Q. In other words, the only way that this horseshoe symbol can be true is when you have the antecedent and the consequent both true. I should say it this way. The only way that it's going to be false is when, you've got to define it negatively because it's true in every other case but one. The only case that it's not true in is where you have a true antecedent but a false consequent. You can't allow that. So you just define it as this is not true. It's not the case that P and not Q are both true. Okay. Now that everybody's fairly confused, I'll just leave you to think about that a little bit and put this truth table down and notice the definition here. It's not infinitely important that you necessarily memorize this, but it is interesting to look at it that way because you can define horseshoe in terms of these other symbols, just a conjunction and a negation that we've had before. Right. This is essentially what it is. Now, it does relate. It does. In a sense, actually, this horseshoe symbol came from intuitive, things in logic. If something's true, then something else is true, and this does correspond to normal logical reasoning. But then you have the question of the case of what if the antecedent is false. That still makes the conditional true, because the conditional, once the antecedent is false, the conditional doesn't tell you anything about Q. So the conditional statement is still true. It's still a true statement that if P then Q, even if P isn't true. Because all the conditional says is if P then Q. And if not P, then it doesn't tell you necessarily whether Q is true or false. It's not going to be called a false statement because it's not telling you anything about Q. You can't accuse it of being wrong if it didn't say that Q was true or false now that you negated the antecedent. So it still makes it a true statement. Now, with that intuitive, idea, this truth table was defined according to this. And another way of thinking of it is that all the horseshoe is telling us is that it's not the case that both P and not Q are true at the same time. In other words, if P then Q is going to be true. It's not going to be the case that P and not Q are going to be true at the same time, or the negation of Q are going to be true at the same time, which would mean that P was true and Q was false. Because the only way that not Q can be true is if Q is false. It's a little bit wrangling-jangling here, but you can stop and think about that for a while, and maybe at your leisure, and you can convince yourself that it's really the case. Okay. But whether or not you can see that, this is the way we define B horseshoe cube. This is the truth table to remember. And it turns out to be the exact same truth table as this expression. So, as we defined it. So, they are equivalent. Okay. Now, just a few more notes on points on recognizing conditional statements in English. In English, you don't always have a nice if such and such, then such and such statement to work with. Sometimes you'll have a statement from that's a little bit worded a little bit differently. And so there are other ways in English of expressing an if-then relationship, so you need to be aware of looking at it. The idea is a conditional. And let's suppose we take the statement, if he has a good lawyer, then he will be acquitted. We'll use that as a model statement, and you'll show you that there's lots of different ways that you can express the same idea. So if we use it in their standard form here, if he has a good lawyer, then he will be acquitted. Now that can be also stated as, if he has a good lawyer, he will be acquitted, by just omitting the word then. Because it's understood in English, if such and such, then the word if is introducing an antecedent and you expect the consequence. And you don't always need the word then in. So if you see a statement like that, it will be the same thing, the equivalent to this. Or you might see the statement, he will be acquitted if he has a good lawyer. That's just reversing them. He will be acquitted, which is the conclusion, if he has a good lawyer. So that's just reversing the antecedent consequence. But that still doesn't change the function of it. It's still the same statement. It's still the statement that the good lawyer is the condition upon which he will be acquitted. Or you might see it this way. That he has a good lawyer implies he will be acquitted. That he has a good lawyer implies he will be acquitted. That's the same saying, if he has a good lawyer, then he'll be acquitted. Same statement. Or another way to say it is, his having a good lawyer entails his acquittal. Okay? His having a good lawyer entails his acquittal. That's still the same as saying, if he's got a good lawyer, then he'll be acquitted. So you see it in some, seemingly disguised forms, but you just need to think about what that statement in English is. What kind of conditional is there? Another way it could be stated is, his being acquitted is implied by his having a good lawyer. And there you put it in the passive tense. His being acquitted is implied by passive form of the verb. Is implied by his having a good lawyer, which is still the same as saying, if he has a good lawyer, then he will be acquitted. So I just give you those examples to let you know that you may see an English conditional statement expressed in different ways. But all of those things that I just stated would be diagrammed logically by L horseshoe A if we say if he has a good lawyer and this is his being acquitted. If he has a good lawyer, then he will be acquitted. All of those statements would translate into this logical expression. Okay, any questions on that? And there might be other ways too. Those are just some of the most common ways that you'll see a conditional statement expressed. Okay. Now for the Greek students, you can apply all the ways in Greek. They make conditional statements here. It's the same kind of thing. Okay, now, one more point here that I'll make about the horseshoe symbol before we go on, and that is this. Sometimes you'll hear a discussion about this horseshoe being associated with what's termed necessary and sufficient conditions. Necessary and sufficient conditions. And let's just try to illustrate what we mean by this by saying, using an example, that Jesus died is a necessary condition for our having life. That's the statement we'll take. That Jesus died is a necessary condition for our having life. Now this can also be stated as, we have life only if Jesus died. In other words, if we're going to say that Jesus died is a necessary condition for our having life, then there's no way we're going to have life except Jesus died, see? And so it's the same as saying we have life only if Jesus died. We have life only if Jesus died. It's the same statement, logically. Or it's the same statement as, if we have life, then Jesus died. If we have life, then Jesus died. And you should recognize that as your horseshoe symbol. If, then. In other words, let's just use the symbols L and D here. If we have life, then Jesus died. And we started out with a statement that Jesus died is a necessary condition for our having life. In other words, the horseshoe symbol means that this condition on this side of the horseshoe is a necessary condition for this being true. If this is true, then this is true. Absolutely, you see. And so this becomes a necessary condition. And this is the way it's sometimes termed in logic, a necessary condition. So in general, to use a generalized formula, Q is a necessary condition for P. And the phrase P, well, let's just say, P only if Q are the same, are symbolized by P or QQ. So if you read across the statement that says Q, that something is a necessary condition for something else, then you're going to put the necessary condition on this side of the horseshoe and this side. It's the same as saying if P, then Q. It may not be obvious from the first look at something like that, but when you think about it again, it becomes that way logically. So our original statement that Jesus died is a necessary condition for our having life. It means that the only way we're going to have life is if Jesus died. If we have life, then Jesus died, you see. That's the point. And it becomes a necessary condition. Okay. Now, dealing with this concept of a sufficient condition. Yeah, Mark, go ahead. In one sense, you know, we use the word conditional to apply to this, if this, and so forth, but I think that's where the confusion comes.
Right.
And that's why we try to make a transition here, P only if Q and this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about here is if this is going to be true, if this is true, then this is, it's got to be true. It's got to be true. If this is going to be true, then this has got to be true. And logically, that can be true from a different perspective. In other words, we're kind of looking at our cause and effect relationship from a different direction. But terming it in terms of a necessary condition, this is what it turns out to be. This is why you get confused with a sufficient condition, which is the next thing I'm going to talk about, and that's just the opposite. So let's talk about the sufficient condition next. And I'm saying that you're not always going to run into language like this, necessary sufficient condition. When you do, you need to know how to translate that into logical terms and make sure you get your P's and Q's on the right side, you see. Okay. All right. That's where that expression came from, minding your P's and Q's or watching P's and Q's. That's what we're dealing with here. I don't know how P and Q got to be the, you know, the standard letters, but all the logical use them. P, Q, R, S, T, and so forth. Not part of the alphabet. Maybe from proposition or something, I don't know. Now, there are some situations in which there are many alternate circumstances, any one of which is sufficient to produce the situation in question. The situation could have been produced by a number of other situations. And so let's just say, for example, that to say that the purse contains 5 quarters is a sufficient condition for it to contain over a dollar. That's one of the many ways in which it can contain over a dollar. It can contain over a dollar if it had 6 quarters or 7 or, you know, a dollar bill and 3 cents or something like that. But to say that the purse contains 5 quarters is a sufficient condition for it to contain over a dollar. Or you could say it this way. If the purse contains 5 quarters, then it contains over a dollar. If the purse contains 5 quarters, then it contains over a dollar. Or in general, we can say that P is a sufficient condition for Q is symbolized by P or Q. Okay, now in this case, we're saying that P is a sufficient condition for Q. Over here, we have Q is a necessary condition for P. And they both are symbolized the same way. They both go out the same way, but you're looking at it from a different perspective. Here, Q is a necessary condition for P. Here, P is a sufficient condition for Q. If P is true, then Q is true. This is going to be a sufficient condition to guarantee this. If the purse has 5 quarters, then it has over a dollar. See? And that's just one of many ways in which that can be true. This statement can be made true in many different ways. But on the other hand, this would be a necessary condition. If we look at our previous example over here, it would be a necessary condition. When you have something stated as a necessary condition, in other words, that's the way it's going to be translated into logical language. When you have a statement about sufficient conditions, this is the way it's going to be translated into logical language. And when you combine the two statements, you come up with something interesting. What's called a necessary and sufficient condition. And I almost hesitate to bring this out. We're just about through the darkness here, and then we'll get into some easier things. The reason we're leading into this is because later on we're going to define an equivalence relationship by this very thing. Is one thing is a necessary and sufficient condition for something else. In other words, they both require each other in order to be true. Let's suppose that we have a statement, if P is a sufficient condition, I'll try to abbreviate, a sufficient condition for Q, and Q is a necessary condition P. Okay. Now, that is symbolized by P worship Q. Okay, so if P is a sufficient condition for Q, and Q is a necessary condition for P, that's P worship Q. That's just combining both of these statements here. P worship Q means that P is a sufficient condition for Q, and it also means that Q is a necessary condition for P. So that's the way it comes out. Now, if in addition to that, we have the statement, if also, Q horseshoe P, that statement is also true, then that means that Q is a sufficient condition for P, and P is a necessary condition for Q. And so if you have both of these true at the same time, P horseshoe Q and Q horseshoe P, then it means that P is both a necessary and a sufficient condition for Q, and Q is a necessary sufficient condition for P when you combine both of these statements together. Because from this we see Q is a sufficient condition for P, and from this we see Q is a necessary condition for P. So you just combine those together, Q is a sufficient and necessary condition for P, same is true here, P is a sufficient condition for Q, and from this, P is a necessary condition for Q, and so combining these two statements, P horseshoe Q and Q horseshoe P is simply stating that P is a necessary and sufficient condition for Q. And later on we're going to redefine that as an equivalence relationship, that both of them have got to be true and they're necessary and sufficient for each other. Okay, now that's just, for now, that's not the most important thing to remember, but we'll bring this out a little bit later on after we work with this P horseshoe Q symbol a little bit. No, not as far as there being the same statement, no. All I would be saying is that whenever and wherever P occurs, then this other thing Q will also occur. And it's you're getting into cause and effect type of relationships, and things that are going to always happen together. Whenever this is true, and the vice versa is true, they're always going to be happening together. Okay. Now, you can think about that too. If P implies Q and Q implies P, you see, both of them are always going to be true. They're always going to be true together. You know? If the presence of Q guarantees the presence of P, and the presence of P guarantees the presence of Q, then we'll get more of a feeling for that later. But for now, just basically the definition of P horseshoe Q is what we want to work with, and now combine that with all the other symbols that we've used. And we'll talk now about arguments themselves. So far, we've just been talking about functions, logical functions. Now we want to put these things together and make arguments out of them and see how we test arguments using this material. So the next section would be argument forms and arguments. Argument forms and arguments. Now, we want to deal with ways of testing arguments for validity. That's what we're here for. That's what logic is all about. We want to be able to test an argument somebody gives and tell whether that's a valid argument or not. Now, one way that's often used in just argumentation to expose invalid arguments is by an analogy in which the invalidity of the argument is more obvious. Sometimes the way things are worded, you're tricked into not seeing the fallacious assumptions or the fallacious reasoning because of the subject matter, and maybe a little bit confusing or something. And so sometimes it's good to put it into use the same argument with different subject matter, and then you can easily see where the logical reasoning is fallacious. Let me give you one example here, and then we'll generalize this. Let's suppose somebody gives you an argument. If Bacon wrote the plays attributed to Shakespeare, that Bacon was a great writer. And then the next premise is, Bacon was a great writer. And the conclusion is, Bacon wrote the plays attributed to Shakespeare. Okay, you can see that, well, you may not be able to see that that's a fallacious argument right on the surface. But people sometimes, you know, when you've got a long premise and a long conclusion of things, it's easy to lose track of where everything goes. And so, someone would say, now, you might agree with both premises. If Bacon wrote the plays attributed to Shakespeare, then Bacon was a great writer, if you agree that Shakespeare is a great writer. And you might agree that Bacon was a great writer, but that does not necessarily mean that he wrote all the plays attributed to Shakespeare, because there's other good things that have been written, like the plays attributed to Shakespeare. So it's a fallacious argument. You might agree with the premises and consider them both true, but you don't agree with the conclusion. The conclusion is false, which means it's an invalid argument. That's how we define an invalid argument. The premises are true, but the conclusion is false. That's what an invalid argument is all. Now, you might say, in rebutting somebody who made this statement, you might say something like, you might as well say, if Washington was assassinated, then Washington is dead. Washington is dead, therefore Washington was assassinated. Okay? It's a little bit easier to see the fallacious reasoning there than with the longer premises. So to say if Washington was assassinated, then Washington is dead, the conditional statement, and then to assert the consequence, Washington is dead, and then to conclude the antecedent, well, therefore Washington was assassinated, is a fallacious reasoning. And we'll see why as we look into this from a truth table definition a little later on. But the whole point I'm bringing out here is that very often we will show the fallacious reasoning in somebody's argument by substituting a different subject matter with the same form of argument, the exact same form of argument, where it's easier to see where the fallacious reasoning is. You get it out of all the confusion of the words that are wrong. And so in general, one way to prove the invalidity of an argument is to formulate another argument which has exactly the same form as the first argument, but has different subject matter, and has true premises and a false conclusion again, so you can begin to see what the fallacious reasoning is. Now, this whole method is based on the fact that validity and invalidity are purely formal characteristics of the argument. It has to do with the forms. It has to do with the way in which the ideas are combined. The form of the argument is what determines its validity, not the subject matter involved. Subject matter is irrelevant, really. It's the form of the argument, the way that these propositions are arranged and how one is claiming to support the other. That is the critical factor in determining validity. And so, if two arguments have the same form, then both arguments are either both valid or both invalid. If the form is valid, then both arguments are going to be valid. They've got the same form. And if the form is invalid, then both arguments will be invalid, regardless of their difference in subject matter. And you see, this is the very essence of symbolic logic. What we're doing is we're looking at the forms, the logical relationships between the ideas, independent of what those ideas really are. That's why we can use P's and Q's and formulate these formulas, not knowing what P and Q represent. We don't even know what the argument is. But having come to these forms, then any argument with any subject matter is going to, if it follows the same form, it'll either be valid or invalid if that form is valid or invalid. And that's what we're trying to get at here. So in order to discuss, in general, argument forms, we need some method of symbolizing the forms themselves. And we've already been introduced with this in these terms of P's and Q's. Now, this introduces the notion of a variable. A variable P's and Q's and R's and S's and these small case letters. They usually use small case letters for a variable. P, Q, that should be like an X, Y, Z in algebra. It just means a quantity that you don't know what it's representing exactly, but it's representing something. Representing something else, and many different things can be substituted into it. So these P's, Q's, R's, and S's are simply what are termed statement variables. They represent a statement. The P represents a statement, the Q represents a statement, the R represents a statement, the S, T would be on as far as we want to go. And so the letter just stands for a statement. You can substitute a statement into that expression, and another statement into the expression for Q and so forth, and tie those things together, and determine whether the argument is valid or not. Now remember, for an argument to be true, it takes more than just a valid argument. The premises must also be true as well. You have to have true premises and a valid argument. But you see, if you've got true premises and an invalid argument, you can still come up with a false conclusion. And that's the thing we want to avoid. Now, compound statements, as well as simple statements, can be substituted for a statement variable. P, for example, might represent a simple statement, just one simple statement, or it could represent a compound statement. In some expression, P could represent a whole other huge big expression, you know, with all kinds of knots and disjunctions and conjunctions and so forth, or it may represent just a simple statement. And sometimes it's convenient to let P represent a whole big expression, to work the, knock the thing down into something you can work with, and then you knock it further down and so forth. And we'll be dealing with some of that later. But when you're dealing with argument form, it's important that you reduce everything to simple statements if you're going to get the final, you know, valid argument described, and we'll define some, we'll be dealing with that in just a moment. Just to say in general first that an argument form is any array of symbols containing statement variables, but no statements. In other words, the argument form is completely independent of the subject matter. It's just something like these P's and Q's. All it does is show the argument in its basic raw form with symbols without using the actual statements themselves. So the form of the argument is just the basic form using symbols independent of the actual subject matter. And of course, when you do this, you need to use symbols that represent the same statement throughout. In other words, when you plug your argument into the form, if your statement P is seen several times in the argument, you better put the same statement in every place where P appears. Otherwise, you're going to be in real trouble. In other words, your substitutions need to be one-to-one. P represents one statement. Wherever P shows up, that statement is the one that's got to go in there and not a different one. Otherwise, you'll foul up the whole thing. You won't have the same argument form. So, for example, both of the examples that we just gave, the one about if Washington was assassinated and Washington is dead, Washington is dead, therefore Washington was assassinated, the argument form would look like this. It would look like this. P, Horseshoe, Q. P, Horseshoe, Q. And then Q, your second premise, therefore P. P, Horseshoe, Q. Q, therefore P. So you've got two premises, and you draw a conclusion from those two premises. And this happens to be an invalid argument. We'll show you why it's invalid just a bit. But that's the argument form for both of the arguments that I just gave you. To say, for example, the first example was if Bacon wrote the plays attributed to Shakespeare, P, then Bacon was a great writer, Q. Bacon was a great writer, Q. Therefore, Bacon wrote the plays attributed to Shakespeare, P. Or if Washington was assassinated, P, and Washington is dead, Q. Washington is dead, Q, therefore Washington is assassinated, P. In other words, you're just substituting the same statement in for all these expressions. This is the argument form for both of those arguments. And if this argument form is invalid, both of those arguments are invalid, you see, because they're just examples, specific cases of this argument form, this general type of argument. Okay, now further, we need to define the specific form of an argument as follows. The specific form of an argument is that argument form which results from using a different variable for each simple statement. You use a separate variable for each simple statement. Every simple statement in your argument is represented by a different variable. In other words, you have no compound statements represented by just one letter, P. P doesn't represent any compound statements. It only represents simple statements. In other words, everything in your argument form is a simple statement. That becomes important because if that's not the case, you may be wrong as far as determining validity. Let me show you why. In this case, this is our specific form of this argument because The P only represents one statement. It just represents the assertion in the second argument that Washington was assassinated. That's all it represents. And Q represents Washington is dead. It's simple statements. But let's suppose we looked at a different argument form that could still describe the same basic argument. We could have an argument P, Q, therefore R, in which case P was a compound statement. P represents the compound statement Q horseshoe R, let's say. And if we take Q horseshoe R and then R horseshoe Q, I guess is what it would be, yeah. In this case. Okay. Now, if we look at this, if we take this out and look at this, then we have the same form as we have here, and we have the specific form. But this form, taking P, Q, and R, that's not the specific form of the argument, because P is representing a compound statement here. So what we want to try to do in specific form is get everything into simple statements, not compound statements. That way you can really test your validity. If it represents a compound statement, then you're not going to be able to really tie it down in the fullest sense. And you'll see that you can be led astray here. And really, with an argument like this, P, Q, therefore R, there's no way you can even put that in a truth table or anything, and it would be clearly an invalid argument. But we'll see that this one also happens to be invalid for this reason. Okay, so only thing to remember is that specific form of an argument is one in which every symbol represents a simple statement, no compound statements represented. You're getting the very rawest, basic form of the argument that you can get. And that's the most important thing for a simple argument like this, to determine validity. Okay. Now, we can use the method of testing by logical analogy more precisely now, because now we've got a real general basic form for all these arguments that we can use. And what you will do then is, once you recognize the validity or invalidity of the basic argument form, then whenever you see a substitution instance of that where you see that you can begin to recognize the argument form, you can tell right off whether the argument's valid or invalid by recognizing the form of the argument and knowing whether that's valid or not. And that will really streamline things. So the way that we determine whether something's valid or not is you take the specific form of the argument, in this case, P, horseshoe Q, Q, therefore P. And if the specific form of the argument has any substitution instance, by substitution instance, it means just plugging values into those symbols and working it out. If it has any substitution instance whose premises are true and whose conclusion is false, then the argument is invalid. This is where we define an invalid argument. The argument is not valid if you can have true premises and come up with a false conclusion. You've got something wrong with your argument someplace. It's not a valid argument. And so we are going to look and test these things to see if we can find any substitution instance, any set of values substituted into the argument that will make the premises true and the conclusion false. If we can do that, if we can find that all of our premises are true but our conclusion is false, then we'll see that the argument is not valid. It's not a valid argument. It's giving us false conclusions from true premises, and that's not logical. Okay, so obviously we haven't got time to try every single possible substitution instance into this argument form. We can try every argument that everybody's ever came up with and every possible proposition that's ever been made. You can't do that. But you don't really need to do that. All you need to do, every proposition is either going to be true or false. There's the only two kinds that there are, you see. And so what we can get by with just considering the truth values of the different types of propositions that exist. And so what we're really doing is considering all the combinations of possible truth values and see if we can get a situation where both of our premises are true and our conclusion is false on a truth table. And if we do that, we'll show that the argument form is invalid. Okay. Now, we can define then an argument is invalid if and only if it has at least one substitution instance with true premises and a false conclusion. So we look through our truth table and we can find a place where you got true premises and a false conclusion, and your argument is not right. It's an invalid argument. Now, also, if any argument form which is not invalid must be valid. There's only two kinds of arguments, valid ones and invalid ones. And so if it's not invalid, then it must be a valid argument. So this will also determine what arguments are valid. So an argument is valid if and only if it has no substitution instances with true premises and a false conclusion. That's a valid argument. There's no way you can have true premises and a false conclusion. A valid argument is one in which every place that the premises are true, the conclusion is also true. And that way you've got a valid argument. Anytime those premises are true, the conclusion is true. Now, it may be possible that the premises will be false and the conclusion is false, but that doesn't make the argument invalid. Whenever the argument has true premises, it's always going to guarantee a true conclusion. That is a valid argument. So, an argument is valid if and only if the specific form of that argument is a valid argument form. And so we have to test the specific forms again to find out whether they're valid, and then any argument that has the same form will also be a valid argument. Okay, so now how do we find out whether this form is valid or not? Well, we're going to use the truth table method again, because what we're interested in doing is looking at all the possible truth values of these different premises, these different propositions, and see if we can find an instance in which the premises are true and the conclusion is false. If we can't, the argument's invalid. If we can't, the argument is valid. Okay, so let's analyze this argument by this method. And I think you'll begin to see this once we set it out in the truth table. Okay, the argument then is P horseshoe Q, Q therefore P. And we're going to test this with the truth table method. P and Q. And all we're doing now is looking at all the possible combinations of truth values, which will represent really all the possible substitution instances of this argument, since every statement is either true or false. Okay, now, we do this by considering all the possible combinations. And so we have one way of doing this here. We true, true, false, false, and then true, false, true, false. This is these combinations of the four combinations of P and Q. And now, just as we've done before, now P horseshoe Q, of course, we already know that from our truth table. P horseshoe Q, if P is true and Q is true, then it will be true. If P is true and Q is false, it's going to be false. If this is false and this is true, it will be true. False, false will be true. Because, again, this conditional is true when the antecedent is false. Okay, now let's look at our argument here. This is one of the, is this a premise or a conclusion of this argument up here? That's a premise, yeah. That's our first premise. And this is the other premise, or we might just label it here. And this is the conclusion, P. Okay, now the argument is going to be invalid if I can find one instance in my truth table where both premises are true and the conclusion is false. If I can find that someplace in my truth table, my argument's not valid. Well, do you find any place where that's the case? Yeah, the third line down here.
Label it 1, 2, 3, 4.
Both premises here are true, aren't they? But the conclusion is false. P is false. And so I found a place where I can have P horseshoe Q true and Q true, but P not be true, with the appropriate substitution of values. And the argument is not going to be valid. There's no way I can guarantee every time I pose an argument like this that just because my premise is true, my conclusion is true, that my two premises are true, that my conclusion will be true, because here's a place in the combination of truth values where that's not the case. So this line proves it invalid. Now, it's irrelevant that in this line it works. All I have to do is find one place where it doesn't work to show that the argument's not valid. There's no way you can guarantee it's true. It may be true in some instances, but it's not always, you can't guarantee it's true. So the argument is not a valid argument. So this shows this argument to be invalid. I can have true premises but a false conclusion. And then if you read the argument, you know, if Washington was assassinated, then Washington is dead, therefore he's assassinated. That's not true at all. It doesn't mean he was assassinated at all, necessarily. Now, he may have been assassinated. It may be, the conclusion could possibly have been true if that were the historical case. But the argument would still not be valid. The premises did not guarantee the conclusion. Because in the truth table, you can see that the premises can be true and the conclusion could be false. Okay, any questions on this as far as testing? So what we do is we put every argument to the test like this, and if we can find an instance where the premises are true and the conclusion false, we have an invalid argument. If you can never find that, if in every place where both premises are true, the conclusion is true, if they were all like this, it would be a valid argument. Okay? Now, let's look at another one that we've seen before. By the way, I might give you the technical term for this argument. is the fallacy of affirming the consequent. If you want a fancy word for it. The fallacy of affirming the consequent. Remember earlier we talked about informal fallacies? Well, this is the formal fallacy category now. Because it superficially looks like another argument, modus ponens, that we'll talk about a little bit later. It looks quite a bit like that, but it's not that, and it's an invalid argument. And it's easy to get a person confused into thinking it's a different kind of argument, and then he accepts it and makes a fallacy. So this is a formal fallacy, and it's called the fallacy of affirming the consequent. Okay, we just got one more minute here. Let's do another one real quick. The one that we saw earlier was the disjunctive syllogism, which meant P or Q, not P, therefore Q. That's the disjunctive syllogism. Okay, this turns out to be a valid argument, and I'll show you why. Real quick here. Okay, so we've got to put down all of our different things. We first put down our P's and Q's. True, false, false. True, false. True, false. Okay, now, with these values, P or Q is going to be true if either one of them is true. So it's going to be true there, it's going to be true there, and it's going to be false there. Not P is just the reversal of P, so we're going to have false, false, true, true. And now, this was one of our premises. This was a premise. This was the conclusion. Okay. Now, we find here, the only place where both premises are true is in line 3. Every other place you have one of them false. So in line 3, both premises are true, and the conclusion is true. Lo and behold. And we don't have any place where both premises are true and the conclusion is false. This is therefore a valid argument. There's no way that if both your premises are right, your conclusion is going to be false. So anytime you have two premises with this argument, you're going to have a true conclusion. And it's a valid argument. And this is the way you test it out, the truth table method. Okay? Huh?
I didn't.
Okay. With this specific one or with one before? Okay. With this specific one, remember, if we're going to try to prove this invalid. We can't prove it invalid, it's going to be a valid argument. The only way it can be invalid is if I have both true premises and come up with a false conclusion. That's what makes it invalid. Now, so I look through here, and these are my two premises. So I look in these two columns, and I look in all the places where I have both of these true. Okay, there's only one place where both of them are true. And I look over here and see if my conclusion is true or false. Well, my conclusion is true. And therefore, this is a valid argument because there's no way I can make both premises true and the conclusion false. The only way I can make it invalid is get both of these true and just get this one false, and I can't do it. So that tells me that any time, no matter what kind of propositions I put in here, if those propositions are true, if my premises are right, then my conclusion is always going to be true with this argument. Okay? Well, no assignment for tomorrow. Just think about that. You might read through them again, see if you can convince yourself to believe some of these things, and we'll do some more work with it. We've got the machinery now to really start going and drawing some conclusions and working with it. Okay, go ahead and hang on to those, Fred, just check them through, I guess.
Yeah.
Mary and Mary.
Thank you.